I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the cause of dying. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a far dying. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the cause of dying keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people.
That's
of course,
what we call it.
Those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, I was in my bank today, and on the, they've got these sort of video screens up above the counter where the tellers are, and almost nonstop you've got this propaganda flying at you. Flying at you, and it's let's see, a rainbow. You constantly see the rainbow. Well, you kind of get the idea, don't you? The rainbow. Well, it's all about the LGBTQ homosexual stuff. And it's a hashtag, forever proud. Oh, wow, forever proud. Whoop-de-doo. And I'm advised that the TD, Trout Dominion Bank, proudly support 100 LGBTQ organizations and 63 pride parades. I didn't think there were that many gay pride parades in the country, but I suppose if they say they're supporting them, I guess there must be. If what people do privately, if they want to put their own money out there, that's their business. But as a customer, strongly object to my money, my bank doing that. I even strongly object, even more strongly object to as a shareholder. And I wonder, and I'm going to watch this come Christmas, will there be any recognition of Christmas? You know, the gay pride parade and so on, but what about Christmas? Do they give any money to pro-family organizations? Or is it just the Forever Proud? You know, some of our most mortal enemies, really, are in the business establishment. And that is a lesson that I think has come, is a hard lesson for many people who grew up, as I did, as a fairly strong, well, I would have called him in the old days, a conservative. By and large, we tend to support business. And unfortunately, the older I've gotten, the more I see that business today in North America, often, not always, and I don't want to blacken an entire profession or an entire occupation, but nonetheless, big businesses often are not on our side. They're part of the social revolution trying to destroy us. And I think that requires a certain amount of realism on our part. Oh yes, more of the Wrecking Crew. Denis Coderre, he is one of the more despicable creatures that's loped across the political landscape in Canada the last 20 years. Denis Coderre was at one point a federal Quebec member of parliament. He was a Liberal cabinet minister and was the minister of immigration back in 2003 when revisionist publisher Ernst Zundel was deported from the United States back to his last country of legal residence, which was Canada. Now Ernst, of course, was held here as a political prisoner. He had landed immigrant status since 1958. He lived in Canada from 58 to the year 2000. Never convicted of a crime. Had run a business. Had paid lots of taxes. Had employed people. A typical hard-working German, but he had some unusual ideas. For instance, he didn't think Germany should be blamed for World War II. He thought that, and I agree with him, much of the story that's come down to us as the Holocaust, and it's actually a new religion, it's not a historical account, but it is fundamentally false and is used for evil purposes, those evil purposes being primarily to make Germans guilty. And actually, it's even more sinister, to make us all feel guilty, even though on a rational basis it shouldn't. Anyway, Denis Coderre was Minister of Immigration back then. Now, it looked at first as though Canada would have to take Ernst Zundel back, because after all, he was a Canadian landed immigrant. Well, that's what you might have thought, and that's probably what most of us thought, but there was tremendous pressure from the Jewish lobby. I think a lot of this was all cooked up in advance. But anyway, tremendous pressure from the Jewish lobby to deport Ernst. Well, how could you do that? Well, the law had changed after 9/11. A new piece of legislation called Bill C-36 had come in. And it was belatedly to deal with the problem of terrorists. Now, not everything in Bill C-36 was wrong, but a lot of it was. For instance, handing over censorship control of the internet to the Canadian Human Rights Commission, where truth is no defense. And the Jewish lobby at that point, in the person of a man who had been the president of the Canadian Jewish Congress, who would become the Minister of Justice at one point, he would argue that we needed to fight terrorism on the internet. Well, there's no terrorism on the internet. The whatever happened on the 11th of September 2001, it was not computers flying through the air and taking down the Twin Towers. Whatever it was, it wasn't that. But no, this was a good way to gain more control. The man I'm trying to think of, his name was Erwin Kotler, former head of the Canadian Jewish Congress. He would later become justice minister. He was at that point a big noise in the Liberal Party. Also part of that evil bill was a new thing called the National Security Certificate. And what that was that if two cabinet ministers signed a certificate saying that you were a threat to national security. Now, this would only apply if you were not a Canadian citizen. So if you were a landed immigrant or a refugee claimant or whatever, if two cabinet ministers signed this certificate, you could be deported. Now, you were granted a hearing, although it really was an example of Indian giving. Yes, you got a hearing, but the evidence was secret, or could be secret. The witnesses were secret or could be secret. Complete violation of Anglo-Saxon law and due process, as we would soon find out. Anyway, when Denis Coderre was one of two cabinet ministers who signed a national security certificate. It was interesting at the time. The press gathered around, and soon after Ernst Sundahl being deported back to Canada in, if memory serves, in February of 2003. They asked, what are you going to do about Ernst Sundahl? And Denis Coderre, who's a short little guy with a Wayne Newton pompadour hairdo, cocked his fingers in his belt like a gunfighter and said, "Watch me." Well, okay, he brought in the National Security Certificate against Ernst Sundahl, and a 2-year farce of solitary confinement, abuse in prison, and the eventual order for his deportation from Canada ensued. I have nothing but contempt for Denis Coderre. A couple of years ago, when Arab terrorists attacked several targets in Paris, including the offices of a very disgusting paper called Charlie Hebdo, it's a satirical Trotskyist Jewish publication that regularly mocks Islam, which is okay, and regularly, in those vulgar terms, mocks Christianity. And I still would defend the right to free speech, but anyway, a lot of people at that point were wearing buttons or putting on their Facebook signs that "Je suis Charlie." You know, we're all in this together. Well, I actually agree with that. Well, so does Denis Coderre, and he spoke at an impromptu free speech gathering or pro-Charlie Hebdo gathering in Montreal the night of the attack. Of course, the attack occurred in the morning of the day, and by that time it was morning in France. It would be still the night before here in Canada. So about 24 hours later, there was a sympathy rally held in Montreal, and there was Denis Coderre running his mouth about supporting freedom of speech and so on. I thought, you lying hypocrite. When you had a chance, never mind you were going to a rally and wearing a Je suis Charlie button or whatever, but when you actually had a chance to do something here in Canada, you failed. No, you're not a defender of free speech, you jumped up little phony. Well, anyway, Denis Coderre he declared, he's a disgusting individual. He declared Montreal a sanctuary city not long ago. I mean, it's bad enough that it's practically open door for the invasion of Canada by the Third World. They just storm across the border illegally from the United States, and we'll deal with them at some point, but we certainly don't send them the message out. We're serious. Well, we do that. We'd send that such a message, and we build a wall. Or, as soon as somebody steps across the border illegally, we snap the handcuffs on, and they go to jail until such time as we can deport them. And, I would say further, You fingerprint them. You do a biometric record of these people, and you let them know. You're banned from Canada now for 10 years. Don't think of cutting this. As an immigrant, a refugee, tourist, you're out of here. But should you come back before that time, there'll be an automatic 2 years in prison. And I would recommend a special prison for illegals. In an uncomfortable, unpleasant place, like Baffin Island, let's say. Give a little bit of employment to some of the idle Eskimos up there, and this would send a message. But we don't send such a message because, frankly, our country's not serious. Or I should say, the dark state, our political elite, are very serious. And they're very serious about replacing the European founding settler population of this country. That's us. Anyway, back to Denis Coderre. So he's in favor of Montreal being a sanctuary city. Oh, hooray. And recently, when there were a number of protests by various Quebec groups against the invasion by these illegals, many of them Haitians, he said, there was no room for hate in Montreal. Yeah, that's right. Well, you hate white people, that's okay, but pride in your own people, oh, what are you, some sort of a fascist? Well, at least from Denis Coderre, British General Amherst's name to be struck from the map. This is an item from today's National Post. Calling it a stain on our history, Montreal Mayor Denis Coderre said Wednesday a street that honors a British general who supported giving smallpox laced blankets to Indians will be renamed. Goodbye, Geoffrey Amherst, Coderre said alongside Ghislaine Picard, who's the chief of the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec and Labrador, anyway, the Indians. At an event marking the 10th anniversary of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, the mayor presented the city's new flag and coat of arms, which includes the addition of a white pine tree to reflect the history of Indian people before the arrival of the French colonists. Amherst Street is in the downtown area, actually it's in a gay area. Now, that is the one take on General Amherst. Well, you might say, well, why would you name a street after General Amherst? Well, let's find out what we can about General Amherst. Geoffrey Amherst was the the first Baron Baron Amherst, and Field Marshal Geoffrey Amherst was the first Baron Amherst. He lived 1717 to August 1797, so he lived 80 years old, which was a pretty good lifespan, especially in those days. He served as an officer in the British Army and as Commander-in-Chief of the Forces. Amherst is best known as the architect of Britain's successful campaign to conquer the territory of New France during the Seven Years' War. Under his command, the British forces captured the cities of Louisbourg, that's in Cape Breton and Nova Scotia, Quebec City, and Montreal, as well as several major fortresses. He was also the first British governor in general of the territories that eventually became Canada. A significant figure in our history. He was born the son of Geoffrey Amherst, a lawyer in Kent, and Elizabeth Amherst. He came from quite a military family. His brothers included Admiral John Amherst and Lieutenant General William Amherst. He served in the War of the Austrian Succession and became an aide to General Ligonier at the Battle of Dettingen in June 1743 and the Battle of Fontenoy in May 1745. Served in Germany in the invasion of Hanover in 1756. He was appointed commissar to the Hessian forces that had been assembled to honor to defend Hanover against the Army of Observation, as it appeared likely a French invasion attempt against Britain itself was imminent. So he served quite a long time in North America. At Louisburg, the general gained fame during the Seven Years' War, particularly in the North American campaign known in the United States as the French and Indian War, when he led the British attack on Louisburg on Cape Breton in June 1758. In the wake of his action, he was appointed a commander-in-chief of the British Army in North America and colonel-in-chief of the 60th Regiment in September 1758. He led an army against French troops on Lake Champlain and captured Fort Ticonderoga in July 1759. And while another army under William Johnson took Niagara Falls, one of his generals, James Wolfe, besieged and eventually captured Quebec City with a third army in September of 1759. Amherst served as the nominal crown governor of Virginia in 1759. In 1760, Amherst led an army down the St. Lawrence from Fort Oswego in New York, what's now New York State, and joined with Brigadier Murray from Quebec. Hello? Hello? From Quebec now. And and he captured Montreal, ending the French rule in North America on September 8th of 1760. He infuriated the French commanders by refusing them the honors of war. The Chevalier de Lévis burned the colors rather than surrendering them. Half of the continent changed hands at the scratch of a pen. The British settlers were relieved and proclaimed a day of Thanksgiving. Boston newspapers recount how the occasion was celebrated with a parade, a grand dinner in Fenoy Hall, music, bonfires, and firing of cannon. In recognition of this great victory, Amherst was appointed Governor General of British North America in September 1760. That's would become Canada, and was promoted to major general on the 29th of November 1760, and appointed a Knight of the Order of the Bath in 1761. He also served in the Caribbean. From his base in New York, Amherst oversaw the dispatch of troops under Monckton and Haviland to take part in British expeditions in the West Indies that led to Britain's capture of Dominica and Martinique and Cuba in 1762, Pontiac's Rebellion. Now, this man is a very significant figure in Canadian history. One more point. The uprising of many Native American tribes in the Ohio Valley and the Great Lakes region, commonly referred to as Pontiac's War, after one of its most notable leaders, began in early 1763. Since 1753, when the French first invaded the territory, until February 1763, when peace was formally declared between the English and the French, the Six Nations and Tenant tribes always maintained that both the French and the British must remain east of the Allegheny Mountains. After the British failed to do this and to withdraw from the Ohio and Allegheny Valleys, a loose federation of Indian tribes, including the Delawares, the Shawnees, the Senecas, the Mingos, the Mohicans, the Miamis, the Ottawas, and the Wyandots banded together to try to drive the British out. One of the most well-documented issues during the Pontiac's War was the use of biological warfare against the Native Americans. The suggestion was posed by Amherst himself in a letter to Colonel Henry Bouquet. Amherst, having learned that smallpox had broken out among the garrison at Fort Pitt, and after learning of the loss of his fort at Venango, his forts at Venango, Leboeuf, and Presqu'île, wrote to Colonel Bouquet, Could it not be contrived to send the smallpox among the disaffected tribes of Indians? We must on this occasion use every stratagem in our power to reduce them. Bouquet, who was already marching to relieve Fort Pitt, agreed with this suggestion in a postscript which he when he responded to Amherst just days later on the 13th of July, 1763. And Bouquet said, not General Amherst, "I will try to inoculate the Indians by means of blankets that may fall in their hands, taking care, however, not to get the disease myself." Historians Elizabeth Fenn and Benedict Clement have shown Fort Pitt had anticipated these orders, reporting on parleys with the Delaware chiefs on June 24th, a trader, William Trent, wrote, "We gave them two blankets and the handkerchief out of the smallpox hospital. I hope it will have the desired effect." Amherst was Amherst was summoned home, ostensibly so that he could be consulted on future military plans in North America, and was replaced pro tem as Commander-in-Chief North America by Thomas Gage. Amherst expected to be praised for his conquest of Canada. However, once in London, he was instead asked to account for the recent Native American rebellion. He was forced to defend his conduct and faced complaints made by William Johnson and George Crowan, who lobbied the Board of Trade for his removal and permanent replacement by Gage. He was now 70, criticized by military subordinates on both sides of the Atlantic. Nevertheless, Amherst was promoted to Lieutenant General on March 26, 1765, and became Colonel of the 3rd Regiment of Foot in November 1768. He was appointed Lieutenant Governor of the Ordnance and soon gained the confidence of George III. Amherst was forced to was raised to the peerage in 1776 as Baron Amherst of Holmesdale in the county of Kent. In 1778 he was promoted to full general, and in April 1778 he became commander of the forces, which gave him a seat in the cabinet. In 1778, the British commander in North America, William Howe, requested to be relieved, Amherst was considered as a replacement by the government. However, his insistence that it would require 75,000 troops to fully defeat the rebellion in the United States, or what would become the United States, was not acceptable to the government, and Henry Clinton was chosen to take over. Following the British setback at Saratoga, Amherst successfully argued for a limited war in North America, keeping footholds along the coast, defending Canada East and West, Florida and the West Indies, while putting effort into war at sea. On the 7th of November, 1778, the King and Queen visited Amherst at his home, Montreal Park in Kent, and on April 24, 1779, he became a full colonel of the 2nd Troop of the Grenadier Guards. Now, there's more to his life, but I think that certainly gives you a flavor of it. He was an important man in Canadian history. Now, might he be controversial? Of course he was. Was everything he did right? Probably not. But he was not named. The street was not named after him. Because he sent or ordered smallpox blankets sent to the Indians to a tribe. There were enemies that were fighting the British. It's not as though this was an attempt to exterminate peaceful people. Right or wrong? Well, probably in our terms today, with what we know, probably wrong. But we don't honor people because they were saints. Wonderful if the person was a saint, but that's not the criteria. He played a significant role in Canada, in the development of Canada. And a street should be named after it. It has been. And there are many Amherst there are towns named that. There are streets. There are schools. This historical destruction is a dangerous thing. And as Conrad Black pointed out in an article I read last week, it tends to undermine the very legitimacy of our country. If some of our forefathers or whatever did these things, did some things that by today's lights are considered wrong, well then our entire place is wrong. Or I mean, that's the way it can come across. And that is a dangerous thing to do, in my opinion. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Go ahead and take a short musical interlude. Excuse me. A bit of a fog in my throat tonight. I'm going to take a short musical interlude here. And I'm going to play one of the really great rebels, David Allen Coe, Long-Haired Redneck. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fight side.
Country DJs know that I'm an outlaw. They'd never come to see me in this dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies, though I pray they'll get out of here alive. Loudmouth in the corners getting to me, talking about my earrings and my hair. I guess he ain't read the signs that say I've been to prison. Someone ought to warn him before I knock him off his chair. But my long hair just can't cover up my redneck. I've won every fight I've ever fought. Some turkey telling me that I ain't country, saying I ain't worth a damn dog ticket that he bought. Cause I can sing all them songs about Texas, and I still do all the sad ones that I know. They tell me I look like Merle Haggard and sound a lot like David Allen Coe. And they barmaid in the last town that we played in knew the words to every song I wrote. She said Jimmy Rabbit turned her on to my last album just about the time the jukebox broke. Yeah, Johnny Cash helped me get out of prison long before Rodriguez stole that goat. I've been the Rhinestone Cowboy for so long I can't remember, and I can do you every song Hank Williams ever wrote. And I can sing all them songs about Texas. And I still do all the sad ones that I know. I can't help it, I look like Merle Haggard, and I sound a lot like David Allen Coe. But the country DJs all think I'm an outlaw, and they'd never come to see me in this dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies who are praying they'll get out of here alive. The loudmouth in the corner is getting to me.
And that's David Allen Coe, Long-Haired Redneck. This is Paul Fromm, And you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Here's another one of the Rebels, Waylon Jennings, the ghost of General Lee.
Through the smoke and the mud and the blood, we walk behind Robert E. Lee. 60 miles from Richmond to face the Union Army. We dug our holes and we built a wall, 'cause we knew there'd be a fight. If the blue coat wearing soldiers crossed the river that night, sure as hell at sundown came 100,000 men. And it sure did shock me, Lord, to see kin killing kin. The cannonballs were heavy, filled with iron and steel and lead. And the James River water ran a bloody red. It's been 100 years, and as I look around, I see a mighty city where there once was a battleground. I thought when they surrendered, we would fight no more. But the ghost of Lee can still see us fight the Civil War.
That's Waylon Jennings and the Ghost of Robert E. Lee. We're going to conclude this musical, short musical interlude with Hank Williams, Jr., If the South Would Have Won. $100 bills. I'd have all the cars made in the Carolinas.
talk with that southern accent, it drives me wild. I'll have all the fiddles made in Virginia, 'cause they sure can make them sound so fine. I'm going up on Overton Mountain and see a Clifton Flowers and have a sip of his good old Arkansas wine. Hey, if the South put a wine with a hide and mane, I'd probably run for president of the southern state. When Patsy Cline passed away, that would be our national holiday if the South put a wine with a hide and mane.
And that's Hank Williams Jr. If the South would have won, we'd have had it made. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And I'm going to take a look at some of the information that's kind of come my way today. This is an interesting opinion piece by Robert Spencer in Jihad Watch. It's called "Allowing Government to Censor Speech of Unpopular Groups Will Lead to Suppression of Views Not Approved by the Government." That's, of course, the risk, the dire risk of government censorship. Freedom of Speech Under Fire. Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States and the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, repeatedly affirmed the rights of conscience as embodied in the First Amendment's protection of free of speech, religion, and peaceful assembly. He said, this is Thomas Jefferson, "No provision in our Constitution ought to be dearer to men than that which protects the right of conscience, or the rights of conscience." What was Jefferson referring to as conscience? Prior to the American Revolution, particularly in the early 1700s and the late 1600s, Americans were forced to support churches not of their choosing. In some colonies, ministers of non-approved denominations were imprisoned and even hanged. From the memory of this intolerance came the insistence upon a Bill of Rights, which included to be included in the newly ratified Constitution. For 200 years, these rights were tested and expanded by the courts into a clearly defined body of law that protected the most important rights of humanity. The right to speak your mind without fear of legal prosecution. It doesn't mean that there won't be social or economic repercussions. Others have the right to disagree with your speech and exercise their own First Amendment right by sanctioning your speech via social isolation and vehemently disagreeing with your views while expounding upon their own. Objectionable speech is best opposed by reasoned speech, not by mob violence or censorship by the government. A growing disturbing trend, however, from a once vigorous defender of free speech emanates from the academic community. A few years ago, this the writer, Spencer, attended an event at Cal Poly that hosted Dr. Robert Spencer, who specialized in the intellectual fight against radical Islamic jihad. A number of Cal Poly students attended, most from various social science disciplines. As soon as Spencer began to speak, a number of students angrily left the room as a form of protest against Spencer's message, exercising their disagreement via the First Amendment without, however, hearing a word he had to say. A group of Muslim students remained for Spencer's entire talk, asking pointed questions at the end of the event. At the end of Spencer's talk, a young woman stated that Spencer shouldn't be allowed to speak on college campuses, as her First Amendment rights protected her against what she considered hate speech. This is something, of course, that she dreamed up, but she was a senior, scheduled to graduate in a few weeks. A sad commentary on how indoctrination has replaced critical thinking in our universities. Several attorneys present in the audience proceeded to correct her misinterpretation of the First Amendment, which protects objectionable speech against the tyranny of the majority, or the sometimes called the heckler's veto. Allowing the government to censor the speech of unpopular groups will inevitably lead to suppression of all views not approved by the government. A very important and dire warning. Well, much is made up here in the Dominion of Canada about the rights and the plight of our Native Indians. Well, of course, they go by different names, and you have to know which week it is to know what name they're calling themselves by these days. In some cases still is Indians, then it was Indigenous people, then it was Aboriginals, then it's First Nations. Yeah, I always have trouble taking seriously a group of people that can't even figure out what to call themselves, but okay. Your tax dollars at work. Audit queries, $546,000 powwow. This is by one of the best court reporters in Canada, Christy Blatchford. A devastating forensic audit of a small Southern Ontario Indian tribe has revealed that a celebratory powwow last year ballooned to cost $546,117, more than twice the original estimate. The audit by a London auditing firm shows that there is virtually no financial controls for the Caldwell First Nation powwow, and suggested that some funds may have been stolen, and the chief, Louise Hillier, was in conflict of interest when her son's company won an untendered $190,000 contract to video the proceedings. Now, the entire event cost $546,000. Of that, her son gets $190,000 to video the event. I know successful movies that were produced for far less than that. I mean, this is just wholesale corruption. The August 28th audit and the temporary suspension of the chief and the entire council. The powwow, which featured unusually big cash prizes in singing, dancing, and drumming. An astonishing total of $280,000 in prizes, mostly unsupported, as the auditors put it, by documents such as receipts, was meant as a celebration of the 2010 settlement of the band's specific land claim. So, okay, this is going to be a big blowout because the Indian band, wait till I tell you how many people are in that band, because in 2010 they won a big settlement. That year, the First Nation, which by the government's account had 368 members. So a band with 368 members spent $546,000 and change on a powwow. The mind boggles. That's almost $2,000 for every single man, woman, and child in Indian in the band. Now, I call that a party. That year, in 2010, the Indian band, which by the government's account has had 368 members, approved the Ottawa offer, and early in 2011, the chief announced the final settlement of the 200-year-old land claim for $105 million. This is down in the Leamington area of southwestern Ontario. The powwow held last summer, that's 2016, was meant to celebrate all that. It was considered a repatriation ceremony and called Rejuvenation of the Spirit. Well, I don't know what spirit got rejuvenated, but the 129-page audit is spirit-deadening. It details an almost total lack of ordinary financial controls. No official budget, for instance, existed for the powwow. All the auditors found
was a draft band resolution. That's a draft. It wasn't necessarily passed. Dated in April of 2016, indicating a budget of $500,000. But the resolution was that was actually passed had no dollar value attached to it. And an audio recording of the council meeting the following month shows councillors discussing a budget of $260,000. None of the budgets noted indicated a cost of $500,000, the auditor said. We are unaware of how between March of 2016 and April 29th of that year, the budget grew from $260,000 to $500,000, or $500,000 plus, actually. Almost every aspect of the of accounting for the powwow costs was deeply flawed. For instance, after a bank investigation, 99 $50 bills were missing from a powwow deposit, and the auditors say, "We understand the police have been notified of the alleged theft and are investigating." The band had no written policies about how large value contracts should be awarded, merely conventions or practices. They called for contracts of $20,000 or more to require three quotations. And there was also a convention that a counselor, quote, cannot sign his or her own check and cannot sign a check for immediate family members. Yet the video contract, which went to the chief's son, his company, Moccasin Media, was awarded in the absence of other quotes, and that was way over the $20,000 threshold. It was never brought to council for approval, and Chief Hillier arranged the initial deposit to the company of $60,000 on her own. A quote from the report: no other individuals, council members or otherwise, were copied on the email about the arranging the funds going to the bank. No other council member approved the bank draft. They say this wasn't just a violation of the band's practice, but was also a violation of the bank's own policy of requiring two signatures for a cash withdrawal or transfer. Quote, we recommend a formal legal opinion to be obtained with regards to whether a conflict of interest existed between Chief Hillier and the contact with Moccasin Media and its proprietor, David Hillier. That's low-key auditor's talk for bringing the police. Though local media reported as many as 6,000 people attended the powwow, only $5,613 was recorded as revenue from the gate fees, meaning at $5 a pop, as few as 1,123 people may have paid to enter. So was the attendance a good deal lower than the media reported, which is quite possible, or were some people, large numbers of people, let in for free, or did they just, things just collapse? Revenue from souvenirs was reported at $2,596, but the band spent $17,197 to buy memorabilia for the powwow. Not very swift in the planning department, are they? Indeed, except for the food and craft vendors, the auditors say they're unable to conclude whether all revenue was received as minimal controls were in place. Cash prizes for the contest were larger than average, which with even the youngest competitors, age 6 to 12, pocketing $400 for first place and $150 for fifth. and don't forget, these are prizes in singing and drumming. Older girls and boys got $800 for first and $200 for fifth. Adult competitors got $1,600 for winning, $800 for finishing fifth, and I guess graduated amounts in between. And even then, the auditors say, cash prizes, prize amounts more than doubled from those that were being contemplated to those that were actually paid out. And the only information about the competitors was their names. We are unable to confirm the amounts paid, and we are unable to determine whether any cash may have been misappropriated, the auditors say. Were these prizes actually ever given?
Or were they pocketed by somebody? Good question. Don't know. Chief Hillier didn't reply to the press. Perhaps the comment the auditor, the worst comment the auditors made was that after the powwow, members sought financial information. We understand no information was initially shared with the members. That's members of the band. So the chief, the council, and the chief kept their many of their own people in the dark. This is one reason that I am many Canadians are severely critical of Indian self-government. For one thing, we should stop pretending that they're nations. They're not a nation. They are people within Canada. Secondly, they're not a nation in that they provide for themselves. Almost all bands parasite off the Canadian taxpayer. One of the first characteristics of a real nation is that it supports itself. And if it doesn't, it's really not a nation. It's somebody else's creature. The people who are hurt at least as much as anybody by these shenanigans are the Indian people themselves. Many of the members of the band are, this is money, a half a million dollars. That's 1/200th of the settlement they got, which incidentally, if we're divided up among each and every Indian there, the $110 million settlement would have given every Indian over $300,000. Instead, the band council will spend it in shocking and ridiculous ways like this. Well, this is Paul Froman. You're on the funny side of me. You're on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of these are Eastern Standard Time.